Welcome, everybody, to the Tennis Worthy Podcast, brought to you by the International Tennis Hall of Fame. I'm Brett Haber, and if you're a regular listener to our interviews with tennis legends, you'll know we generally focus on one person per podcast. Well, not this one. In 2021, the Hall of Fame inducted a group of people for the very first time. That group was the original nine, the nine women who, in 1970, risked their futures in tennis by standing up for the right of female players to have their own tour and be recognized on equal terms with the men as an integral part of the sport of tennis. Our main interview in this podcast is with two of those original nine, Judy Teagart-Dalton and Rosie Casals.
When open tennis happened, we were not getting the piece of the pie that we thought we were going to get.
We took the risk and the other people weren't prepared to do it.
We were told no, 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 and we said yes, yes, yes.
And later, we're going to hear from someone who wasn't one of those nine because she was pregnant at the time, but was very much an active supporter of the birth of women's professional tennis, the former Roland Garros and Wimbledon champion, Ann Jones.
We turned up and we sat there, Judy Teagart and Judy Dalton and I, we sat there looking at each other, thinking, well, what's going to happen now? Are there any courts here for us to play on? Where's the tournament? You know, it's really quite funny.
But let's hear first from Judy Dalton and Rosie Casals, who were the U.S. Open women's doubles champions in 1971. As I said, they were inducted into the Hall of Fame in 2021, but because of Australia's travel rules aimed at keeping COVID at bay, Judy couldn't make the trip to Newport then, but she made up for it by attending the 2023 enshrinement ceremony in Newport, and the following day, she and Rosie spoke with Blair Henley.
I am so honored today to be joined by Judy Teagart-Dalton and Rosie Casals on the Tennis Worthy podcast. And one thing I found when I have now met the full original nine in person, of course, this fearless group that broke away from the men's tour risked potentially not being able to play professional tennis anymore, is that each of you have your own personality, your own role within the group. So I'd love to do a little exercise here. And Judy, have you describe what you saw Rosie's personality and role being in the original nine? And then I'd like to reverse that.
Oh, well, I knew Rosie from a long way back. So, but as you say, each of us had to play a part and we each did it in the way we felt we wanted to do it or we felt we should do it. And I think that for each part, it all came together like a jigsaw puzzle as a whole. And because of it, we've always been really good friends, like even if it might be 8 or 9 years, say, for instance, in my case, where because I live in Australia, I don't see everybody, but when I do, it's like as though it was yesterday. So we still have this camaraderie because we all had to work to make it work. And it was, to me, it was like a jigsaw puzzle, you know, putting it all together and then making it a whole.
Sure.
And we were, for Kerry, Melvin, Reed and I, it was quite difficult because we got a really hard time in Australia. We weren't allowed to play any tournaments or any, and we weren't allowed to play any tournaments, no Australian Open. We weren't allowed to use any Australian equipment. And I was very lucky because I knew Maureen Connolly then. I emailed her because they didn't have texts or, remember, they had to telegram things. And she said, look, use my, because she had a racket with Wilson. So I used Wilson rackets and Wilson shoes and everything for nearly 2 years because we weren't allowed to use any Australian equipment or anything.
I want to get later to why you kept going when there were so many things standing in your way. But Rosie, I'd love for you to describe Judy's personality, the way that you saw it then and now, and why it worked for the original nine.
Well, we've known one another quite a while, and I think saw you at Wimbledon, or even before that, I think Manchester Beckenham, one of those tournaments.
And
so I knew she was an Australian and a very good player at that. And so when she came to the States, and we all been to Australia, well, I was going to go to Australia in 66, that would be my first year. But, you know, Judy was, I think, someone who was pretty outspoken and seemed to be pretty much of a leader in that area. Kerry was a little bit younger than she. So I think that, you know, she schooled Kerry and said, I think this is something that we really need to do. And it was a risk for sure, as she said. She was ostracized not only by the Associate LTA Australian, but other players that felt, Margaret Court didn't feel that what we were doing was the right thing. And even though we thought we had invited her to join us, she did not. I don't know how you felt about that, but I think that, felt a little bit like not getting the support that you needed, because at that time she was number one. So I know it took a very strong character to be able to go against everything that you've ever had, and being one of the top players in Australia, as was Kerry, it was a big risk to come along and become a part of us.
Which of you two is more outspoken?
I think she is.
That's because... I think we are in different ways, but certainly...
We've got things done together, which is important.
Absolutely. When you didn't have that support, did you ever have second thoughts about what you were doing?
No, not really, because I thought it was the right thing to do. And I suspect that I've probably been against federations, because I've always had a bad... Well, I did. I always had a bad relationship with our LTAA. And so I was always outspoken with that, and so never gotten any teams or was never chosen anything because of it. So I felt, why alter the situation?
Well, you both are so matter of fact. I've now heard you both speak, and there's very much a sense of, well, this was the right thing to do, so this is just what we were going to do. But you realize, though, that there were many people who might have also thought that, but who did not have the courage to move ahead. So what was special about you guys?
We took the risk, and the other people weren't prepared to do it.
Well, I think it's like anything. There are those that, when they say they're going to do something, they do it. And I think that, we had been talking to a lot of the women throughout that year and through the summer circuit and everything, when we realized that really money was not being equally distributed, certainly like a 10-to-1 ratio prize money for the women, and they were really being neglected. Billie Jean was number one, and the men were getting priority on courts and finals and times and schedules and what have you. And so finally, when we got to the U.S. Open, we realized that, look, we really need to do something drastic. And so although we had a huge group listening in the locker room there, that little locker room.
None of them were prepared to take the chance.
A few of us made a statement by saying, okay, we're going to stick to this. Gladys Hellman came into the picture and talked to us, and we asked her whether she would talk to Jack Kramer. At the time, that was the issue of prize money at the Pacific Southwest, and he was very unwilling to change it. And so we said, well, we're going to go on our own. Gladys said, great. I'll put the tournament together in Houston at the Racquet Club, and we'll get Virginia Slims behind it. And kind of that's how it went. The minute the U.S. Open was done, we flew to Houston. So there wasn't a whole lot of time there. Mm-hmm. And the women that were made that commitment, some like Patty Hogan and other players who Margaret Court was supposed to show up. She did not. She chose to go fishing, and Patty Hogan chose not to, defy
they played in
the
England,
association.
Didn't they?
And so, here were these nine women, very committed, and knowing that, it was a big risk.
Mm. And it was interesting Kerry said, well, if Judy knows it's the right thing, I'm prepared to do it. But I can tell you her parents were not at all happy with me. They said, why are you doing it? And Kerry said, no, it's fine, don't worry. And, and then when we had all the rocky bit, I thought, I don't know whether her parents thought, I really have done the wrong thing. But I think in the end they were quite proud of her, actually.
So you had lots of people who were upset with you at one point.
A lot.
Amazing. Yeah. And you stayed the course.
Yep.
In 1970, when that iconic photo was taken of you all with your dollar bills, Women couldn't open credit cards. They could be fired for getting pregnant. They couldn't serve on juries. There were no women's endurance events at the Olympics because people felt they were too strenuous for women. Can you give us any specific examples of the attitudes that you faced during that time, specifically to you all as women's professional athletes, and how you change people's minds?
Yeah, because it was something new, but we had Women's Lib going on. So, you know, Gloria Steinem and things were happening in the Capitol and the march and everything. So I think we realized that this was a good moment to get behind the women and get our point across of the fact that we were women who wanted to play a sport, and tennis was the one that we were involved in, and the support that we should have been getting, and certainly prize money that we expected to have it with open tennis, we were not getting. So we realized that, you know, the game hasn't changed from that point of view. Men are still running the tournaments, promoting them, and very little women involved in all of that. So it was something that was difficult to maneuver, because every time we needed to talk to somebody about women, it was a man. You know, it didn't matter. We'd go to the USTA. It's a male who you're talking to, and therefore, can they see your point of view? I would say not. Most of them did not, because it was the times. You know, women didn't play sports. You know, 1972 didn't come into the picture for women's scholarships for sports and education till 1972, Title IX. So, you know, we were ahead of the curve, really, in wanting to be equal in not just prize money, but recognition and exposure that we were not getting. But thanks to Gladys Hellman, Virginia Slims, and Billie Jean's leadership, and the original nine who went out on that limb, signed the dollar contract, because at that time we could not play in, or the tournament would not be sanctioned unless we were pros, and therefore the dollar indicated
a significant
that we
amount.
Signed a contract with Gladys Hellman to be able to play that tournament, or else we couldn't. So we were told no, 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 and we said yes, yes, yes.
I was reading at one point that you were passing out flyers, almost like a poll, to ask if men would be interested in watching and engaging in women's tennis. Can you tell us about that?
Esme Emanuel and Cece Martinez decided they were going to do a survey with the public at the U.S. Open, and they were out handing all
they're
these
amazing.
Exactly that they put together. Mm. And as it turned out, just about almost everybody said that they were interested in watching women's tennis, and that
especially,
you know,
the men, because they could associate the game.
Yeah, we had a good crossover of men wanting to watch women's tennis, which gave us even a further push that what we were asking for was possible, but that there were sacrifices, obviously.
Incredible. Judy, at the beginning for you, when tennis became open in 1968, you described it as you weren't making a living, but you were surviving. What kept you going? Because you were an accountant, I believe,
right?
You had a day job. You could have gone and sat in an office.
It was boring.
fair enough. But what was it that pushed you to keep going with your professional tennis career, but also to be this trailblazer when people were not thrilled about it?
Well, it was interesting because in Australia, they would only let us play 6 months of the year at one stage. Everybody, the men and the women. So what we did, well, it was hard, really, because, you know, you had to work. And then I saved my money. I bought chairs. Because when they had, you know, when they floated companies, in those days there were 5 shilling shares, which doesn't mean anything to you as Americans.
Pretty cheap.
It's pretty cheap.
Yeah.
And then I just watched when they floated on the stock market, they'd go up a bit, so I'd sell them and put that money aside for the trip. And so that's how we survived. And it was interesting because when I played Billie Jean in the final of Wimbledon, which was the first Open Championship, she got half of what Laver got. So I think Laver got £1,500, Billy got £750, and the runner-up would get half of what the... So, in theory, £375. And our tennis association in Australia wouldn't let me have any of it because they didn't recognise it as open tennis.
Wow.
So I think I had to play in England for something like 4 weeks or 5 weeks for £150. That's what they gave me. So, and Billy didn't know
cheap,
that.
Cheap.
Oh, very cheap. Yes.
So where, how were you, how were you surviving?
Well, we got appearance money, so okay. Under the table.
That was the whole idea of going open because you would get money under the table. So it's amateurism. Mm-hmm. And that's what, you know, Billie Jean hated that. And I think we disliked that because nobody knew exactly the value, what was he getting, what were you getting, but that is how we survive in the amateur days, is getting, you know, $300 for the week or, you know, $400 and staying privately with housing and that kind of thing. But once it became open, you know, that's exactly what it means, open. And we didn't want the money under the table. We wanted to earn it just like everybody else, but there wasn't a whole lot.
Rosie, you wrote an op-ed for World Tennis long before 1970 with this vision of what women's tennis could be. I think you actually lobbied for a female head of the USTA. What did you tell yourself that made you think this was possible? Because at the time, this was not something that most people could envision whatsoever.
Well, I think coming from the wrong side of the tracks where you always have to fight for everything and, you know, to be the right to be recognized, the right to be able to play. And I think that I've always been pro-women, being a woman, and knowing that, you know, it's always an uphill battle for women. You always have to do things twice as, you know, better as well. than a guy, and so you always have to be louder and fight for the things that you really feel are important. And I think that was kind of my makeup, that when open tennis happened, we were not getting the piece of the pie that we thought we were going to get. Now, mind you, we were contract pros prior to that with George McCall, and we had Labor and Roseau and Pancho Gonzalez and played with the guys, and there was Frankie Durr, myself, Ann Jones, and Billie Jean. And so we'd come a little bit from, you know, having the guys have more than the women, but we shared, we learned to share, and we understood that, you know, there was a give and take there. And I think we were ready to move and bring that business of being a professional athlete and playing for the money. What is wrong with that? We practice, we, you know, commit our lives to being the best we can be. Why can't we say we're pros and accept prize money that would make you feel equal to the time that you're spending and certainly the men? And so it was something I think that was already inherent in me that to fight what I felt was correct.
On that note, how much of what you two were able to accomplish on the court and off the court do you think stemmed from your upbringing and then also your athlete mentality? How big of a piece of the puzzle was that, Judy?
Well, I think it was a huge part because when we started, we did everything. It's not like today where they get everything given. We did clinics. We went to shopping centres, do appearances in shopping centres. We did radio, and we all took it in turns so that the people who lost, say, in the tournament, then went off to the next tournament to do all the PR for the thing. So we started that, and it was really, you know, it was really good. And then if somebody, the other part that was really nice, which I liked about, was that if somebody was not playing very well, and everybody, we would all have our input in to say, look, how about trying this, or how about doing this, or maybe you could try this to improve, you know, so that we each helped one another so much.
It's hard to understand that today
it
because
is.
The tennis players and their teams are really isolated.
It's grown a lot. from where, you know, we sort of started where, you know, like I said, everything we did, we understood the public relations that we were taught by Virginia Slims, and they were a marketing machine. Mm. They knew how to promote, and even though it was a cigarette company, and most people would shun that, if it wasn't for them, women's tennis wouldn't be where it is today. Yep. So they just knew how to promote, and they had the money, you know. Mm. They were no longer allowed to promote on television, so they wanted to look for a way in which to get out there, and it was through, you know, promoting women's tennis. And I've got to say, again, if it wasn't for Virginia Slims, I know women's tennis wouldn't be where it is today. And if it wasn't for the original nine and leadership of Billie Jean and Gladys Heldman and Joe Coleman from Philip Morris, the money that they put in was quite a bit, and the marketing and the prize money that we ended up at least coming up with in the first year. I think Billie Jean ended up winning $100,000,
which was unheard of.
Yes. And nobody thought that was going to be possible in the first year of Virginia Slims. I think the next one winning $1 million was Martina. Mm. So, yeah, it's come a long way, baby. Mm.
I think sometimes there's a perception that once the Virginia Slims Tour was formed, that it was this shot out of a cannon, upward trajectory, and things were smooth sailing from there. But there was so much still to be done. And of course, the WTA wasn't officially formed until 1973. Can you tell us a little bit about those years? And you mentioned having to do the press and promote it yourselves. What were some of the other challenges during that time?
Oh, there were many, because we had to, I mean, we were lucky in a way that there were people who would support us. But I think we were actually at a right time, really, because Virginia Slims, or Philip Morris wanted Virginia Slims, and it was a new cigarette that they had, and they had this new brand.
For women.
For women. And, like, we came at the perfect time, and it worked out. And as Rosie said, if it hadn't been for Philip Morris, we could never have started it, because we wouldn't have had finances or anything.
And there was so many, the USLTA at the time, trying to figure out who were contract pros, how do you sanction, who are the registered players, who are the, you know, independent players, can we let the contract pros play with it?
Independence.
There was a lot of politics, a lot of situation that they needed to determine, you know, what they were going to do, because it really impacted the players, it impacted the tournaments. They wanted to be sanctioned, but, you know, if you were a contract pro, you couldn't sanction. You know, there were so many different categories that was confusing to everybody. And all we wanted, if you're a pro, you get paid, that means you're the best. Okay, anybody else, either we're talking about amateur tennis, meaning that you don't get paid, you get expenses, you plan on going to a university or whatever, but if you were a pro, you got paid, and that's who you were, you know. Mm-hmm. So, there were a lot of things.
It wasn't clear-cut at all.
That made it difficult for us, because, you know, we're in the process of growing our tour, and then the USTA decides, oh, we're going to have a tour now with other women, and we're going to get Virginia Wade, we get Margaret Court, and we're going to get Yvonne Goolagan and Chris Evert, and we're going to rival your Virginia Slims Tour, which they did. Hmm. And instead of putting us all together, they divided us, and that was, you know, a little bit of a challenge for us. But again, we had the money, so we put them out of business and got those players to come to us.
Eventually, they saw that how successful we were and what we'd done.
We were very successful, because today's generation never would think that. Yes, we played at Madison Square Garden.
Yeah, that's right.
In Boston, you know, I mean, we played at the Forum and the Sports Arena and all the
we
big
did. At Houston,
stadiums,
at the Astrodome, we played.
Yeah. Mm. So, tennis was big, and then when we got to the 74, 75, tennis was flourishing.
At what point did you maybe have a moment where you thought, okay, mindsets are changing? And obviously we can look back and see the progress, but was there a moment for you too where you thought to yourself, this is big?
Well, I think really when we started the WTA, I think when we really got the attention of all the women to understand that they need a unified body to represent them and to make sure that all that the women would come under that umbrella so that we could get things done and, you know, talk as one voice instead of having different things. It wasn't easy because, of course, Australia's far, so you had to convince
Australians were not on board at all.
How long did it take?
Look, I think it took a little, and the president made a lot of difference. Whoever was the president made a lot of difference. You had somebody who was open-minded and who would accept. For instance, we had a president called Wayne Reid, who I'd grown up with, and he was very open-minded about all that. But some of the others were just so close-minded. And also, because we were so far away, it was very difficult. America was where it was all happening. And I think in England to a certain extent, but for us down under, it made it really difficult. Yeah, and it was a long way, and we didn't really realise all was happening. And I think also their attitude to us was such that I think that they felt threatened by us. Yeah. You know, the officials were absolutely threatened. Yeah. And there was no women in any situation whatsoever in Australia. You didn't get an opportunity to do anything, you know.
Same thing in Europe. I mean, you know, we went through the same thing trying to... the Europeans came over and some of the players played and realized, oh, well, this is really good. And so, you know, but it was difficult because with all the governing bodies in tennis wanting to pull their way, it was difficult. Yeah.
So knowing what it took to change all of these minds at a time where that was almost impossible to do. Do you think players today understand what it took?
Oh, I don't think so.
Well, you know, it's like your parents telling you about the depression, you know. Maybe not your parents, but ours is older, so they would understand the hardships. And, you know, it's hard for them, and I don't expect them to know every part of it, but I do expect them to know the history of the game and how it came about and why they're enjoying what they enjoy, you know, and for them to get back to the game and to support their association. And we were talking earlier about, you know, today's players and difficulty in communicating with them directly and them having their team and their representative and agents and how, you know, it is hard to talk to them. It's hard to meet them, hard to know them. I mean, I don't know half of them, and I would love to be able to see them, meet them, know them. And I think that they should know some of the older players that made it happen for them and understand, you know, where the game came from. Because then I think if you understand the history, then you're more
appreciative
and wanting to really do more. And knowing that you have a responsibility, because you do, to the game of tennis, as you are making a living playing this wonderful sport, you do owe something to the game. Mm-hmm.
Judy, this has been a big trip to Newport for you. You are, of course, part of the Original Nine, as is Rosie, which became the first group to be inducted into the International Tennis Hall of Fame in 2021. You were not able to be there in person because of Australian COVID restrictions, and you are finally making your trip to the International Tennis Hall of Fame. What was the highlight of this trip for you?
It was just fantastic. When we were all inducted and I was still at home, I was in the kitchen of my place and trying to imagine what it was like. But when you actually stand there, and like last night, I made a little speech. It's really very emotional, and you don't realise quite what it's like until you actually stand here. And the atmosphere is fantastic. So it was really quite emotional last night, I have to say. But I didn't think it was going to be like that.
Interesting. Yeah. So what would you say it means to you to be a Hall of Famer? Can you sum it up?
Oh, it's fantastic. It's interesting. I was talking to Rick this morning, who was inducted last night, and in America, the Hall of Fame is really so well known. In Australia, we have a Hall of Fame, but they do a bust of the bronze bust, and it goes around the Garden Centre. And the Hall of Fame is quite well known, but the International Hall of Fame is not really quite so well known as it is here. So to be here and to know the tradition and everything is really special.
Well, I know I can say, because I was here in 2021, that you were certainly missed. So we're glad to have you on the grounds. And Rosie, you are, with good reason, a regular here. You're one of only two people to be inducted into the International Tennis Hall of Fame as an individual and as part of the group. Have you been showing Judy around?
Actually, not. I'd lost her this morning. We were trying to figure out what happened to her, so I ended up walking without her. But we were talking about the fact when we first were here in 1971 with the Virginia Slims and Jimmy Van Allen and his new scoring system. So the women were one of the first to play here, and it was pretty special then. Seeing the grass, seeing the casino, quite not in this form that it is now with the Hall of Fame and everything. So it's always a pleasure coming back and seeing everybody and, being with the new inductees. And certainly, you know, this is like a tradition. It's like Wimbledon. It's like a Grand Slam.
Rosie, if you had to sum it up, what would you say makes you a Hall of Famer?
Well, being here, I guess, and being inducted, I know for sure I'm a Hall of Famer.
That's right.
And as you said, twice, and I'm trying to figure out a way so I can be thrice. So, it's really something very special to be honored by your peers and recognized in the Hall of Fame. And as Judy says, perhaps the International Tennis Hall of Fame is global. It's global, and they've made efforts to get out there and, you know, provide rings and wonderful Hall of Fame jackets and everything to make it special for those inducted. So, even though it resides here in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island, it's still a very global Hall of Fame. So I know Kim Clijsters is out there promoting, and, you know, It's the greatest place on earth when you finally get there, as Judy mentioned, to finally, you know, get up in the stage and be presented with your jacket and your medal and to know that you're a part of this incredible family.
And what you've created and what you all started has turned into the preeminent women's professional sport. Equal prize money at all four slams in 2022. It was $2.6 million at the U.S. Open.
It's quite frightening.
Did you dream of this?
No, I have to say.
Well, I mean, you know, we didn't dream in the sense of dollars and cents. Because, you know, for us, $1 million was a lot. For $100,000 was a lot. So to dream in that respect, but we dreamed, I think we all believed, or else we wouldn't have done what we did and worked so hard and so long, because most of us, when we retired, we were tired. You know, we were older. We're, you know, late 30s and early 40s. And I think that what we want and wanted was for them to understand what it took, and for them to continue, you know, growing the sport, doing something for the women and their game and their association, because I think that is what you invest emotionally, and it's not just to take the check, because half of them don't even know what they win.
No,
it's not
no
about
idea.
The money. Yeah, I mean, for those that are coming up, it's about the money. For us, that was it. Don't give me the trophy. No. Give me the check.
Yeah.
Do you ever see a check now?
No, never.
I mean, do you ever see you won $1.3 million at Wimbledon?
No, never. Nothing. No.
You know?
Yeah. Judy, you told us a story yesterday about being thanked in a unusual setting. Can you tell us that story for the podcast?
Yes, we were playing golf in Scotland at the Renaissance Club, which is now where they play the Scottish Open golf. And there was a girl behind the bar, and she came over and said, was I Judy Dalton? And she said, I just want to thank you for what you've done. She said, I would never have been able to have had a professional scholarship. And she said, I would never have been able to play professional soccer. And she said, you don't realise what influence you all had in doing what you did to other sports, not just tennis, which was just wonderful to hear that. And hopefully they got the photograph, because I sent it to all of them and said, look, this is what you've done. This is just a fantastic effort. That really rang very true, that we don't know. We don't know what influence we had. We might have had a lot in tennis, but we don't know what other influence we had on the other sports.
We are seeing so much happen for now. Women. Mm-hmm. I mean, in sports. And not just sports, but business. I mean, your business. Mm. And companies and CEOs. I mean, we're still lacking. We're still behind. We still need to improve that. But because I really believe of what we started in the 70s, it flourished and seeped into the other areas of women who are trying, whether it's politics. I do want to see a woman president before I kick the bucket. We've seen everything else.
We'll never see one in Australia.
But, we have influenced other sports, and granted that tennis is the mecca, tennis is the elite. It is the showcase for women in sports. But we have, I think, instilled and inspired other women in other fields of sports and also business and journalism and everything, because there hardly ever was any women in journalism, you know. So I think it's come a long way, and I think that we had a lot to do with it. And so, of course, you know, we are proud of that, and, you know, we hope it continues to grow and not become an issue anymore, you know.
But it just happens for the best person.
Always says that, you know, men and women need to get along as equals, and I agree that it can't always be one or the other, and that's at some point. And I see more tournaments coming together with the men and the women, organizing them and working closely together, and I think it's a good thing. But I sell power to the women.
Love it. All right, I would love to close by asking you both one more question, and that is, what is your greatest, when you look back, your greatest accomplishment? Judy, I'll start with you.
I think establishing the Original Nine and what we did. And from a personal point of view, I suspect that Rosie and I actually won the US Open doubles together, which was a pretty good achievement, I must say.
I'd say.
Well, we got threatened by Billie Jean. If we didn't win, that was it. So we did.
I think she was having her knee surgery.
Yes, she was. Yeah, so. And also, from a personal point of view of mine, to getting to the final of Wimbledon and playing Billie in the first Open, which was really important.
Incredible.
And for me,
you got to say the doubles.
Okay, because that was special as well. But, you know, I think being a part of the Original Nine, being a part of WTA and one of the founders, all the things that we've done to fight for women's rights, separate from tennis. Tennis is always something that's more personal, I think, with your goals and things. But to know that we did something very special, bringing a new beginning to women's tennis and sports, and especially the association, WTA, very proud of that. We're celebrating the 50th anniversary of WTA, so it's been a lot of fun. We had a nice thing at Wimbledon, then
and the
caught up with many of the gals from the past. So it's, I have to say I've had a very rewarding profession and career.
Well, as someone who played sports growing up and played college tennis and low-level professional tennis and now works in journalism as a woman in tennis, I want to say thank you to you both, and thank you for joining us on the podcast today.
Pleasure.
Super. Our pleasure.
Blair Henley talking with Rosie Casals and Judy Dalton. And how many other women must there be like Blair who, whether they know it or not, have reason to be grateful to the Original Nine? Of course, there were other pioneers around that same time. In fact, of the three top women players at the end of the 1960s, Margaret Court, Billie Jean King, and Ann Jones, only Court held back from endorsing the Rebels. You heard Rosie Casals mentioning Ann Jones in that interview. Jones was pregnant with her first child when the Original Nine signed their dollar bills, so wasn't in Houston to be one of the quote-unquote $1 professionals, but she was probably the only leading supporter of the initiative not to be there. Having beaten Billie Jean King in the 1969 Wimbledon final, the very outspoken Jones told Chris Bowers that the solidarity among the women players was such that King was simply one of the pack, albeit the de facto leader.
No, she was just another tennis player. We all got on, as I say, we traveled around. We had to set up women's tennis. You know, it isn't often you take on the men and win. not very often. And we took on the men, and in the end, we won. And we were all friends. And we did a lot afterwards of building the women's game, building Virginia Slims. And, you know, she was the leading light, but she couldn't do it on her own. There were the rest of us. We had to do some of the interviews, because the only interviews we could get were probably 6 o'clock in the morning or 11 o'clock at night, and they all had to be shared round, and we all did our bit, you know, to build up the circuit.
I mean, when we think of the three at the top of women's tennis in those days, you, Billie Jean and Margaret Court, I mean, three more different characters, hard to imagine.
Yes, I agree with that, yes.
But you got on perfectly well with each other?
Yes.
And there was the solidarity among all three of you?
Well, no, there was the solidarity between those of us who joined and started Virginia Slims. So and that was sort of more, and the four of us who joined George McCall's group.
Because you were set to turn professional just before tennis went open in 68.
Yes, we did turn professional before, in 67.
So you were only a rebel professional for about 6 months?
Yes.
So you were prepared to actually turn your back on...
Well, we had to do something.
You know, might not have won Wimbledon.
No, that's right.
You might not have been able to play it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. But Wimbledon was sort of more or less was on our side, I think. I'm sure that Herman David, I think, was in charge at the time, and he didn't like the way that the amateurs were being paid. A lot of money for those days, a lot of money for the tennis players in those days, you know, a few hundred dollars here and there. All under the table to play tennis, and that Wimbledon wanted it open. Not that we thought that they would do it at the time, but it's hard to think back, you know, how it all worked out. But we turned pro. There were the four of us. There was Billie Jean, Rosie, Françoise Durr and myself. And we played with the men. But I learned a lot out of that. I got a lot out of it. I was a much better player when I'd finished.
Because such as?
We played with the men. We practiced with the men. The boy, there was Emerson, Roy Emerson, Fred Stolle, Andres Jimeno, Pancho Gonzalez. Pancho spent ages trying to teach Frankie how to serve. It was really quite funny because he had this sort of very funny sort of boop like this, and he spent ages trying to change that. It was quite entertaining. But they were the men would play with us and talk to us and teach us, and so I learned a lot out of those months. But I suppose, in a way, I was lucky that Wimbledon decided to open up at that particular point. So the you're talking about solidarity. The solidarity was between the four of us, and then there was Betty Stover, and a few others joined us. And we did get a bit miffed that because we were sort of separated out. We separated ourselves out, if you like, and Virginia and Margaret were left. And they took advantage of the vacuum that we'd left by sticking with the national associations, which we... resented a little bit, I would say.
Was there a sense of revolution? I mean, 68 was a strange year politically because it was riots across Europe. Mm. Did you get a sense of we're in the vanguard of establishing women's sport?
I think we felt we were in the vanguard of establishing women's rights within the sport of tennis. And that's how it started. I know what you were saying about Billie Jean. Billie Jean has moved on. She's done a wonderful job for women in lots of different ways. She's acceptable at the White House. She knows Elton John. She knows some really famous people. She is a mover and shaker, as we would say. But at the time, you have to realise we were so pissed off with the national associations because... They told us we could only play 180 days abroad. My association, the British Association, the LTA. You know, you can only travel abroad 180 days. And I wanted to play in Houston or somewhere. And I was already over there for the Caribbean circuit. I didn't want to come back and play in Bournemouth. If you don't come back and play in Bournemouth, it's our national clay court challenges. You won't be selected for the Whiteman Cup. And if you're not selected for the Whiteman Cup, you can't go to the US Open or the American Championships as it was then, because I couldn't afford to pay. So, you know, they ruled us. And you were expected to play in the local against Wales or against Scotland or against Ireland or something, which was fine as long as it fitted into the calendar. But when they wanted you to play straight after Wimbledon on Monday, Tuesday and Wednesday, and when you wanted to go to the Welsh Championships, it didn't work out very well. And they objected when, if we said no, when there was retribution. So we were fed up, and I was fed up with mine. And you can imagine with Billie Jean's, she was totally fed up with the USTA because there was Karen, who she played doubles with, Karen Hans. She wasn't, if you weren't in the top four, you didn't get paid anything to play in the American Championships. And this, it was more or less the same in Wimbledon. There were some of us who were given, money to pay to stay in London, as long as you stayed in the Championships. Once you lost, they didn't pay you any more, per diem or something, they called it. And then there were the youngsters, like Christine Truman and myself and Sheila Armstrong. We were called the junior or the young players, something or another, so we got a bit of money out of it. But the rest of the players didn't get anything. And it's fine. It's fine. If you go to a tournament, then they will put you up and they will feed you and you play your tennis. But if you can't do that, you can't. How do you get there? For me, when I started, I had to play in, well, I wanted to play in varying little tournaments around here, like Moseley and Sutton Coldfield and a few other tournaments, and they would pay you £5 or something or another in a voucher form for winning. So then I thought, well, now I need to go to Bristol because Althea Gibson's at Bristol and I need to play some of these better players. So the money that I won went into the train fare to get to Bristol. So, you know...
You were a real amateur.
Yes. Yes, we were. We were total amateurs. And then when it, you know, you're backtracking really, and I'm going around in circles. But when it came to our fight with the various LTAs, we were fed up with them telling us where we could go, who we could play doubles with. I wanted to play with Renee Schuurman. She's South African. I didn't want to play with some British player. But they ruled us. And we always felt that they didn't have that right, but we didn't have any money to take it to court to fight it. We always thought that they were infringing our civil rights.
So when you see the original nine who signed for $1 in September 1970,
yes,
getting a lot of credit, do you feel that actually the four of you who first broke 3 years earlier should actually share that credit?
Yes, I think most of them were there. I was the only one who was missing, and I was missing because I didn't play the American Championships that year.
Well, you're pregnant, weren't you, or had you just had your first child?
No, I was pregnant, that's right. The 1 year I didn't go, I should have done. I was seeded one in the American Championships, but I didn't go because, I was a bit injured, and also probably I just won Wimbledon, I'd probably had enough. The following year, 1970, I was pregnant and I didn't go. I went to the US Open. I did commentary for the CBS, I think. But I didn't go to Los Angeles, so I wasn't there. So they all did that then. But then I did go to the Virginia Slims thing, the very first one in San Francisco.
Because your husband was the chief executive.
Yes, he looked after... He was put in charge by Gladys. Gladys didn't want to travel. She got Joe Coleman to put the money. To put the money in. And we all arrived in San Francisco. Oh, that's right. We played the Federation Cup in Australia over Christmas. And we all went from, and Frankie and I, we went to join the Virginia Slims rebel circuit, if you like, straight from there. And it was quite funny, I suppose. And we all arrived there, and this lady, nice lady called Ellen Merlot, she arrived she worked for Philip Morris. I'm not quite sure she knew what she was doing. We certainly had no idea. You know, we turned up and we sat there, Judy Tegart and Judy Dalton and I, we sat there looking at each other, thinking, well, what's going to happen now? Are there any courts here for us to play on? Where's the tournament? You know, it's really quite funny. And I'm not sure Ellen Merlot knew a lot. She was supposed to be in charge. I'm not sure she knew a lot more either. But we all got together. I think Larry King set the thing, the first two tournaments, and he got a sponsor. Funnily enough, it was a British Motor Corporation or British Motor Company or something.
So it's all very in-house.
Yeah.
Because Gladys Heldman asked your husband to be the chief executive.
Yes.
Billie Jean's husband comes in to find sponsors.
Yes.
I suppose that was the nature of, that was the necessity of it.
Yeah, well, it was, yes. We were a closed group and I was going to go anyway, so Pip said he didn't mind looking after the... Looking after the difficulty was moving the court because we played on this rubberized something or another, and we couldn't have the they couldn't afford to pay for the whole week indoors, so we had to play outside on cement courts or what you call them acrylic courts for a while, and then we moved indoors and played. I suppose it must have worked enough anyway, and. So Larry found, I think he set up the actual courts and the venue and that kind of thing. But I don't know all the ins and outs of it. But Pip was in charge of this court. And, of course, we played on a Sunday night and it had to be at the next city on Monday morning, this court. So he had to get somebody to roll it. He had to roll it up. It was in strips. You rolled it up and put it on a truck and you drove it to the next city. It was quite funny, actually.
An insight into the remarkable reality of the early years on the rebel women's tennis circuit in the early 1970s. Ann Jones talking there with Chris Bowers. Easy to assume that where women's tennis has gotten to today was somehow inevitable, but really it wasn't. It took those very brave actions by the original nine and others like Ann Jones and Françoise Dürr to make the breakthrough. And that's why they are honored in the International Tennis Hall of Fame. Ann Jones, a Hall of Famer in her own right, will feature later in this second season of the Tennis Worthy podcast. But next time, we'll be completing our set of continents with our first interview with a Hall of Famer from Africa. That would be Cliff Drysdale. So do join us for that. And if any of your tennis friends don't know about these interviews, please do tell them about the podcast and where they can find it. The Tennis Worthy podcast is brought to you by the International Tennis Hall of Fame in association with the Tennis Radio Network. I'm Brett Haber. Thanks so much for listening, and we look forward to your company next time.